September, October, November. Have a time you'll always remember. At beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Make your fall fabulous at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Do all the things you've wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Mountain Comics, the show where I look back at the comic books I bought while on vacation in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 1980s. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And joining me in the cabin this week is our pal, Dallin Baumgarten. Hi, Dallin. Welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. Hi, Rob.
I said welcome back, but you have not been on Mountain Comics before. You've been on other shows of mine. You haven't been on Mountain Comics. So welcome back to the network, but not necessarily this show. I'm excited to have you. We have a really fun comic to talk about. Marvel 2-in-1 Annual Number 6. This has been on my list of Mountain Comics to cover since season one, and nobody picked it. Nobody's ever picked it. And so I don't know
why. I'm surprised you picked this comic because it's a little small for a treasury.
I did with what I could when in the comics I found up in the Poconos. I did find a couple of treasuries, but not a whole ton. So before we get started talking about this comic, Dallin, like I said, so you haven't been on the show before. I want to ask you, do you have something like this in your past, like a comics that were like bought on vacation or bought at like a specific time or place that was separate from your kind of daily existence?
Not really. I think 98.5% of the comics I bought as a kid were from, one spinner rack, at a corner store, except for like the three packs, and the treasuries you could find at the bookstore, but no, there wasn't like a regular destination for our family or anything like that. If I could sneak into an antique store somewhere on the road, and pray that they had a few comics in there, I would, but I don't have a mountain comic per se. My memories are of driving to our grandparents' house and taking the comics that I had and putting them in the, I had two older brothers. I had to sit in the middle of the back seat. And in the old cars especially, you'd have that little that little shelf underneath the rear windshield. Mm-hmm. And that's where my little stack of comics or my treasury could go, And I'd have to scrunch to turn around and get to the pile, But yeah, that was my memory was taking them with,
Gotcha. Okay. Now, did your brothers read comics too, or were they just you? No.
No.
Okay.
No, they were into the, they were into the sports cards and things like Weirdos. That. But yeah, right? Nerds.
So, now, of course, you don't have vacation comics, but you have like tour comics where you pick up comics on the different locations when you've been on out there touring as a musician. So, you kind of have your own sort of version of that.
Yeah, I do now. I didn't when I was younger and traveling a lot. I was usually too broke or just didn't have the time to do it. But
right.
Yeah, but nowadays I do. I definitely try to hit any shops that I can.
Oh, that's it. Someday we've talked about this. Someday we got to do like a show about that. I just want to hear these stories.
A travel show, yeah.
Yeah, travel show / comic book show. It's a winner. It's a total winner. Coming soon to the Fire and Water Podcast.
Why isn't anybody doing that instead of like American Pickers?
Yeah, totally.
We got to do it.
We got to do that. All right, we'll talk about that off air. So, okay, as they said, we're here to talk about Marvel 2-in-1 Annual Number 6. It was on sale July 14th, 1981. Now, I'm going to do the synopsis. I tried to keep it as brief as possible, but as I mentioned, this is an annual, so it's a longer story than normal, and it was written by Doug Mensch, which means it's even longer than by a lot of other stories.
Well, while you're doing the synopsis, I'm going to open my Yoo-hoo.
There you go. Perfect.
Sadly, I couldn't find bottles this time, so it's just like a little juice box.
It was a little juice box. I appreciate
it. It's not authentic to the time period, but
that's all right. I appreciate your commitment to the bit. And then I'm going to mention at the top, everybody, is that unlike other episodes of Mountain Comics, we're going to talk about some of the ads in this book. So when Down and I are after the synopsis and Down and I are going through the story itself, We're going to stop occasionally and talk about the ads in this book, and you'll be able to see all these ads and other pages from the comic on the website, FrontwaterPodcast.com, in the accompanying gallery post. So the story is called An Eagle from America. As I mentioned, it's written by Doug Menich or Doug Menk. I'm just going to say Menich and just stick with that because it's
a I've never understood why you say Menich.
I've only
ever heard Mensch or Munch.
Doug Mensch. All right, I'll stick to that. Doug Mensch. Let's say Doug Mensch. Doug Mensch, Ron Wilson, and Gene Day. Before we even get to the story, though, this cover by Ed Hannigan and Walt Simonson is, yeah. I think it is beautiful. And I can remember... I remember this cover gleaming out from the racks. I can remember which store up in the Poconos had it. It was the newsstand that was closest to our cabin. They had two racks, wire racks of comics attached to a wall, and they went very high. They went like way above my head. And I can remember seeing this one. And Marvel 2-in-1 was a book that I didn't buy regularly. It was, you know, being a team up book, you kind of go with it unless you're a huge Thing fan. You
kind of go with it. I bought it religiously.
Oh, you got it religiously. I was about to ask you. You got it religiously. Okay.
Whenever I could find it, yeah.
Gotcha. I mean, I always liked the Thing, but he was not enough to be like, oh, I'm going to buy it every single month. So we would depend on who the guest star was. But this cover is so pretty. It's this sort of slightly abstract kind of thing. It's very interesting in that there's not much in the way of blacks on it. It's all kind of lit in a sort of almost stained glass kind of manner, and we see this profile of the character who we learn is the American Eagle. We see the Thing, Wyatt Wingfoot, Kazar, and Claw the Unconquered, and there's a bunch of text, all new double-sized blockbuster, and it mentions, you know, introducing the American Eagle. So I assume you agree with me, this cover is just really beautiful.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm not one of those people that can remember every single book, you know, when I bought it, and like I said, most of them were bought off that same spinner rack for years, so the memories kind of, you know, mushed together a little bit. But I really do think that I remember grabbing this book. You know, it was, I'd been reading comics for several years, but this cover really stands out. It's a marvel. It really is. And the way they've got the illustrator, they could put twice as many words on this. As long as they shove them over to the left side of the cover, they could do what they want, you know.
Right.
It's just such a great cover. I don't know if Hannigan had this finished product in mind when he was doing, you know, the pencils the way he was doing them, but man, it just turned out brilliantly.
I'm going to assume that since he was a cover designer, that this was his work, that when he handed it off, presumably to Walt Simonson to ink, that he specifically mentioned, like the way you would do it in the comic book pages is you would spot the blacks and that you would put a little X in the spot where you want the inker to fill it in all black. That's the indication to the inker, fill this in with black. And most, you know, I'm assuming that in this point he would, you know, like specifically like in the Thing's crevices there, instead of it being black, it's blue, it's colored blue, that he specifically left it blank. And maybe for the, you know, maybe he indicated what colors he wanted to go on there, or he let the colorist handle that, but it's really, really striking. And I love the way the elements all blend together, that Wyatt Wingfoot is sort of blending into American Eagle's mask, blending into the Thing. And then you've got the Claw's leg kind of coming out of the Thing's head. And then you've got Kazar. I mean, again, it's a really, really striking motif.
You could stare at it for a long time. It really is. It just, they pulled it off. Whatever they were going for, they pulled it off.
Yeah, it's really nice. Now, this comic is 75 cents, of course, which was more than a full quarter more than comics were at this time. Did that ever stop you? You know, like if you saw something, did you have to make that kind of balance? Sometimes we were like, well, I get less comics, but this thing is double sized. Or did you just not worry about that?
I mean, I was forced to worry about it because I only had so much money in my pocket, but
okay.
You know, there were times when I bought as many as I could afford and maybe left a few on the rack. You know, pedaled that bike as fast as I could back to the house and then begged my mom for an extra buck or two, you know, or, you know, I'm ashamed to admit occasionally, you know, sneak a few quarters out of her purse, you know, but yeah, I mean, I couldn't buy every book that I wanted, but if it was the Thing or if it was an annual, like the annuals were, they just, they got me all worked up. You know, they were special. If I could come up with that extra quarter, I would snag the annuals.
Yeah, I didn't. Sometimes I would have to kind of make that balance, but often I just was like, well, I want it so bad, I'm willing to forgo something else. Cause this thing really was just so beautiful. I mean, when I look back, when I was initially starting Mountain Comics and I was using Mike's Amazing World to find, you know, to source all the comics that were around, would have been on sale around July, August. And I got to this cover, man, it was just like a, you know, right in the head, you know, like, whoa, yeah. That one. Yes, of course. You know, so it's really, really beautiful. Again, you'll see it on the gallery post accompanying this episode. So, okay, let's get to this story. As I mentioned, it's called An Eagle from America. With the other members of the Fantastic Four and Alicia Masters busy, the Baxter Building is empty, except for the ever-loving blue-eyed Ben Grimm, a.k.a. The Thing, and he is bored, bored, bored. He whiles away the time lifting weights, but then is interrupted, gladly, by the FF's old pal, Wyatt Wingfoot. Wyatt has come to seek the FF's help and tells the Thing about some trouble that could spell grave danger for two members of a neighboring Native American tribe in the Southwest. Wyatt tells the story from many years ago when white settlers were threatening his tribe's land. When the chief was wounded in battle, the tribe needed a new leader, but the old chief's two sons both wanted to take control. Unable to decide which should be the chief, both of them were sent into a cave where great spirits reside, and they will decide who should lead. The two sons fight, with one winning out over the other. He is crowned chief and helps fight off the white settlers. But then after the battle, this leader is turned into a wisp of smoke and vanishes. This story relates to what's happening now. A mining company wants to dig on tribal lands, and the tribe's two leaders, Ward and Jason Strongbow, don't agree on what to do. Ward wants to allow the miners to dig and reap the profits, but Jason does not. This leads to a fight between the two brothers in a sacred cave, a fight from which only Jason emerges. Seemingly gifted with newfound powers, the tribe believes Jason is infused with the spirits of legend. After a protester is shot, Jason searches after the killer, who has made his way to the Savage Land. Wyatt wants the FF to help him get there and find the killer. The Thing, of course, agrees to come along. In the Savage Land, Jason Strongbow, now in his role as American Eagle, is searching for the killer. When he fires at some miners who are about to kill an animal, Kazar mistakenly thinks Jason was the one trying to kill it, and they fight. Eventually, they realize the truth, and they stop fighting, just in time for the Thing and Wyatt to arrive. They compare notes, and American Eagle tells them what really happened in the cave. While he and Ward were fighting, the leader of the mining expedition, the supervillain Claw, because of course it is, arrived and attacked them. Jason was infused with radiation, which is what gave him his newfound powers. Claw then escaped. Nearby, Claw and his team are extracting vibranium from a dinosaur graveyard, having penned up the remaining beasts. The Thing, who believed Claw died at Project Pegasus, wants to know how he survived. Claw tells him that the cleaning lady at Project Pegasus unwittingly reactivated a sonic blaster inside which Claw was trapped. You just can't get good help nowadays. The Thing and Claw fight, while American Eagle fights his brother Ward, who did not die in the cave as the tribe believed. One of the miners takes a shot at American Eagle, but misses and kills Ward. After defeating Claw, our heroes then corral the rampaging dinosaurs. The Thing apologizes to Kazar for bringing such trouble to the Savage Land, but Kazar says to save the sympathy for American Eagle, who is mourning the loss of his brother. Whew! Okay.
Yeah.
That's as usual, when it comes to Doug Mensch, you get value for your money. I mean, that was a long synopsis, and I even left some stuff out. So we're going to go through this kind of, you know, scene by scene, but overall, what are your feelings about this story?
This is a, I love it. It's a great, I mean, it's a true annual. They even give you a brand new character, you know, but there's just a lot going on. It's an epic tale, and they don't pull any punches with this one. Is it as well known as, Two-in-One Annual 2 or, you know, with Thanos, or what was it, number 7, where the Thing, you know, is in the boxing ring?
Yeah,
it's not up there with some of the, you know, the most well-known iconic annuals, but it's a solid book. You know, you got your 75 cents worth.
Oh, absolutely. You get the feeling, and this is not at all meant as a criticism, that this is like, if this was like a TV show, this is the backdoor pilot for American Eagle, because it's really, yeah, American Eagle's story. The Thing is kind of in one case, literally along for the ride, and he doesn't get a whole ton to do. He's kind of the, you know, why Wingfoot's like, can you help? And Thing's like, yeah, sure. And they go out there. Meanwhile, we've gotten the American, we've gotten the origin of American Eagle. We've got an action scene with American Eagle where he takes on Kazar, which makes Kazar, of course, the third character in this book. So this is Marvel 3-in-1.
Yeah.
If you want to leave out Wyatt Wingfoot. And then he gets kind of the final beat at the end. So this Mensch, obviously, I think, thought a lot of this character and thought maybe there was a lot of potential to it. And so the story is really about him. And I think he's wonderfully visualized by Ron Wilson, who gets a creator credit for the character, actually, in the splash page, which is sort of interesting. I would have assumed that since it was written by Mensch that this was a co-creation. But apparently not. It says American Eagle, character created by Rampaging Ron Wilson. What do you think of the American Eagle as a character? Both the power set, the costume, his raison d'etre. I mean, what do you think of him as a superhero?
He's fun. Marvel was, you know, I dare say they were always a little bit ahead of their time, you know, when they brought in, you know, minority characters and, you know, they tried to be diverse in little ways here and there. I mean, even Wyatt Wingfoot, you know, he'd been around for years at this point. But yeah, I give him huge props for just, you know, bringing in a new character, even if they never thought to themselves, okay, we're going to launch a new American Eagle number one, you know, that doesn't really matter to me, but bringing in, you know, expanding the universe and bringing in these other characters, that's what I loved. You know, as a kid, I loved all those B and C and D and E and F list characters, man. That was what fattened that universe and made it so appealing to me.
Yeah,
I think he's great.
Yeah. We'll get to him when we get to his debut. We'll talk about the costume in a little bit. So the opening.
And you said, no, wait a minute. You said that the thing, it's not really his story and he doesn't get to do quite as much. But I mean, think about poor Wyatt Wingfoot. He shows up, tells the thing a tale, and then throws a rock. Like, that's his thing, you know. I love Wyatt, but Wyatt really got the short shrift in this one, you know.
I have not kept up with Marvel Comics in the last several decades. I really haven't read a regular Marvel series in a very long time. So I don't know whether Wyatt Wingfoot has ever been grafted into some sort of superheroic role. It seems like something they would do. Now, yeah. But I mean, it's like, it's kind of amazing. Like, that's kind of why he was never that big of a deal. Cause he's just kind of like a regular dude. Yeah. He's a Marvel Universe regular dude. And then he's huge. You know, he's like the size of The Rock.
Yeah.
But you know, he's always just in a t-shirt and jeans and he just can't compare in terms of the sizzle to all the other Marvel characters that are in these incredible costumes with incredible power.
That's what made him so great to me. You know, I didn't need another costume superhero. Wyatt was great. He was Johnny's college roommate, or, you know, it was like, that's enough. I loved it.
And wasn't he She-Hulk's love interest? Didn't they do that too? That they were dating? I thought that was a thing at some point too.
I don't remember how much of that was in the comics, because I have, there's still working my way back to rereading the FFs and whatnot. But in the She-Hulk graphic novel,
he plays
a big part. Yeah.
That's right. That's what I was thinking of by Byrne. Yeah. So anyway, I love this opening, and then, you know, Hulk is bored and he's wandering around the Baxter building and he's pressing these weights that are like, you know, 40 megaton kind of things, which is, of course, you know, sort of a classic Reed Richards thing that he built for the thing to, you know, build his muscles up. And the first detail I really love is that after Wyatt Wingfoot tells the thing the story, right, of the ancient legend, the thing is, calls it a corny legend.
Yeah.
Haven't you met Galactus? Like, why is what Wyatt told you any more silly than anything else that happens in the Marvel Universe on any given day?
Yeah, that happens a lot in Marvel Comics, and you just kind of got to go with it. But there's plenty of times when characters go, you're kidding me. That really happened? Like, have you seen the Ghost Rider?
Yeah. I mean, look at it. So there's a cosmic cube.
Yeah.
What is this? Is really, this is Ben, this is not the 100th strangest thing you've ever seen. What the hell are you talking about? So, okay. So before we get to that, the flashback, we have our first ad that we wanted to talk about.
Well, wait a minute. Let me back up just a second. This opening splash cracks me up in hindsight, because when you make your way through this annual, they've divided it into chapters, which I'm usually a sucker for. I love that. But the funny thing is, there is no chapter one.
No, it's just the start. Yeah.
It opens and then you get a chapter two and so on. But I thought it was kind of funny that they just, no chapter one here.
Yeah, it's just the thing pacing going around. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. so, like I said, our first ad is a half page Heroes World ad featuring some toys that you could buy. And there is a custom drawing by Joe Kubert, or at the very least from the Joe Kubert School, but I'm pretty sure it's Joe Kubert. And it's talking about these miniature figures that were available. And what's fun is it's an amalgam of characters that you would never get to see blended together too long after this. Because once all the companies started separating their IP, you know, they were like, no, we can't have them blended. But this is a fun little ad. You see Spider-Man waving, looking very happy. Captain America, Wonder Woman, Punch from Chips, Dracula. Behind Dracula, Darth Vader, and behind Captain America, Yoda. And it's a Yoda that kind of looks like, I think Joe Kubert had never seen Star Wars or Empire Strikes Back. He only had a brief idea of what Yoda was, maybe from sort of a pop culture osmosis. But I find the ad very charming, because when are you going to see Wonder Woman and Punch from Chips in the same
spot? Yeah, it's adorable. And they're describing the figures that you can send away for that aren't pictured. Yep. And it just cracks me up. You can get Punch. John, Punch, Sarge, and Super Foe.
I don't know who that is.
I don't know who that is either.
Yeah, I don't know. and it's funny. It says collectible miniatures, but the Chips dolls were not miniatures. They were like 8-inch Mego dolls. So I'm not sure what they're even talking about.
I wasn't sure either if this was because they said that they're like 3.5 inches or something, right?
Yeah, I know the Chip. As far as I know. I don't think Chips, they ever did Chips in the Star Wars size. I mean, Chris Franklin is the toy expert, so maybe he can clue me in, set me straight. But I don't think they ever did. I think Chips are always just the 8-inch dolls. But
you get the General Lee car that holds 3¾-inch Bo and Luke figures, but no Daisy Duke.
No, yeah, well, you know, well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can see why you'd want that, but then maybe it's not a good idea to let little boy. I don't know. Who knows?
The bigger the better on that doll.
Yeah, you betcha. Now, there's another little blurb in here for Marvel Collector Comic Sets. And I love the way that Heroes World made these sound like these were sort of like specially packaged things for collectors. And they really weren't. They were just, this was their inventory that they had lying around. And they were like, look, we can package these. And, you know, maybe sell them off this way. So there's 10 sets, and I'm going to read what comics are in these sets. And Dallin, I want you to tell me which of these sets you would have bought. You have $3. Okay. Each set is only $6. So you have $6.
Spoiler, I bought all of these.
Okay. So the first set is, and these are all pretty much number ones or number twos. So it's set number one, Ms. Marvel number one, Red Sonja number one, Man from Atlantis number one, She-Hulk number one. All right. Set two, Eternals number two, John Carter, Warlord of Mars number one, Shogun Warriors number one, Logan's Run number one, Star Wars number six, and 2001 numbers 6 and 9, which is, I love six, it's so random. Like, they clearly just had them lying around. Set number three, Spider-Woman number one. Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry, I'm skipping one. Set number
Howard
two,
the Duck.
Howard the Duck number question?
Who knows what you'll get?
Who knows what we've got in the back? We haven't figured that out yet. Set number three, Spider-Woman number one, Human Fly number one. Oh, Maxi Romero's excited about that. What If number two, She-Hulk number two, Logan's Run number two. Set number four, Machine Man number one, Rom number one, What If number three, John Carter number two, Man-Thing number one, King Conan number one. Set five, Micromots one, Spider-Woman's 2, 3, and 4. What If six, Ms. Marvel two, Machine Man two. Set six, Battlestar Galactica's 1, 2, and 3, and the Battle Galactistar Treasury. That's exciting.
Oh, man.
Set seven, Star Trek's 1, 2, 3, 4, and the Star Trek Super Special. Set eight, Dazzler number one, Man from Atlantis number one, Human Fly number one, Machine Man number two, Moon Knight number one. Set nine, Rom 1 through 4. Set 10, She-Hulk 1 through 4. Okay, Dallin, go back. You're a little kid. You got $6 to spend. What set are you buying?
If hindsight is 2020, man, I mean, I was a diehard ROM reader, but I missed issue number two. And I missed it for decades. So anything that had ROM number two in it was probably what I would have gone for.
Okay.
Set number nine, maybe, but then I would have had doubles of 1, 3, and 4. I don't know. Yeah, it's so hard. I don't know. And I was a big King Conan fan.
I'll see. Yeah, you know, throwing a wild card like that.
It's hard to answer because a lot of these are the books that I picked up. You know, I had pretty much all of these books.
Some of them you're getting more than others too, which is interesting. Yeah. Like set number one, you're getting 5 comics, and then like set number two, you're getting like 8 comics. So I mean, in terms of dollar value, you want the ones that are more, but then the other ones are a little
set
more.
Number 6 has a treasury.
Yeah, right. And then so
I'm going with 6.
Okay. Oh, you're gonna the treasury tipped it on the over the edge for you. Okay.
Oh, but you know what? Now that I think about it, is that treasury issues 1, 2, and 3 at Battlestar Galactica?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So you're getting the same comic twice.
So again, oh man, they really make it difficult.
Yep, yep.
And you gotta buy like 5 sets if you want, you know, the complete story, the issues 1, 2, 3 of almost anything until you get to those later sets where it's like, okay, we're going to send you 1 through 4.
I love that you can buy the complete set of 10 for $50. Like, what kid had $50 to sit? Right. Like fortune back then.
And then you're getting like 3 issues of, you know, a few different things.
Yep. Yep.
Three copies.
I didn't mean to torture you. I thought this would be a fun exercise, but I don't mean to.
But those are all books that I was buying. I swear.
For me, I think I probably, I'm not doing it as I would now. I'm looking at it as what at 10-year-old me would have bought. I think I probably would have gone with set 8, Dazzler 1, Man of Atlantis 1, Human Fly 1, Machine Man 2, and Moon Knight number 1. I liked Moon Knight a lot, and that's a bunch of cool number 1s. So I think that one probably would have been it.
That's a good set.
Yeah.
I bought that Dazzler. Man from Atlantis.
Man from Atlantis, man.
Human Fly, number 1. I love the Man from Atlantis comic. I mean, I think it's all Mantlo, and it's good. It's good enough for me.
There you go. Okay. Well, all right. Like I said, everybody, we'll have this ad in the gallery. Let me know what set you would have bought. See if we can get some sort of consensus here.
And so, which 3¾ figures.
Oh, that's right. Yes, exactly. By the way, I love the way Dracula is peering from behind the rest of the ad. Like he's kind of like lurching in. It's very Dracula like pose. I like it a lot.
And there's no way Yoda's 3¾ inches.
No.
Because if Captain America's 3¼, right, then Yoda's 1¼.
Right. The Yoda's the size of a thumbtack. You know, you're like, it doesn't make any sense. So,
he better be less expensive.
Yeah. Yeah, really. And then the other ad is immediately following that. And it's kind of, you know, a little bit makes your eyes kind of pop open a little considering the story that we're reading, which is a Tootsie Roll ad, which bears the heading Indian Legend. And it has these kids talking. And you can send in for some Tootsie Roll merchandise, because who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't want a Tootsie Roll blanket or beach towel, for God's sakes? But, it was a long time ago, and, you know, we don't judge these things kind of the way they, you know, we look at them now. But considering how hard I think Doug Minch and Ron Wilson are working to present American Eagle as an exemplar of his people and a fine hero in his own right, to see this, you know, to see Indian Legend kind of used as sort of like just a cheap sales gimmick in the same book, you're just a little like, okay, yeah.
Time I could see that. I could see that. But, you know, the little Indian image on the wrapper was just something I grew up with, you know. Mm-hmm. It was just always there. But, you know, what really caught me was when I turned I was cracking up because the panel before you turn the page, you know, Wyatt says, the thing says, you said something about superstition. Yes, from gossip about whatever actually happened. And he mentions, you know, being the fulfillment of an ancient legend. And then the thing says, you don't say. And then you flip the page.
And there's the Indian legend. Says,
I know the secret of the Indian legend.
It's perfect timing. I don't know. I have no idea how they slotted ads in. You know, I know that, you know, when they were a Marvel House ad, they probably had some control of where they went. I don't know if Marvel had specific you know, instructions or the printer did it. But yeah, of all the places for this ad to show up, it really
did. They get a little extra, you know, revenue from Tootsie Roll that month. They're like, listen, I promise you, you're going to sell some merch because, you know, every kid's going to read this story and want to know that Indian legend.
I guess
it's going to happen. You're going to sell out of beach towels.
Yeah. And a Tootsie Roll hat and a t-shirt. Yeah. I don't know. Do you like Tootsie Rolls? I've never was big on them. They're fine, but to me, they're a little too chewy.
I liked them, but yeah, when you get a little older and you've got a couple of fillings, not so hot.
Yeah, and then you're like, all right. So, but it's nicely drawn. I like the style, these little cute kids and stuff. So, yeah, again, it's incredibly fortuitously placed in the story to have at the moment for why it is going to go on this whole story about what happened in his tribe. So, okay, so we're back to the story. Wyatt tells this Indian legend. Of course, the panel borders are kind of like this wispy sort of smoke thing, which is always kind of the clue that it's a flashback. And then a nice touch is the entire sequence is not colored. All the panels are tinted with a slight yellow kind of
it's
a parchment
sepia tone.
Yeah, and then the captions have a little bit of an orange and papery thing. I thought that was a nice touch. You know, I thought that was cool.
Well, especially considering that a large chunk of this story is flashbacks.
Yeah,
I mean that it doesn't bother me. You know, but almost half of the story is, even when there's not flashbacks, somebody will, an editor's note will give you like a one panel flashback or something, you know, it's kind of funny. So I'm glad that they did a little differentiation.
Yeah. I mean, there is the sequence where the spirit appears and he's in all red. That's where the one color pops. But again, I thought that was a nice touch to do it that way. I don't think I mentioned the, colorist is George Roussos, the legendary Marvel colorist. So I mean,
and I'm sure it saved George a little bit of time too.
That too. Hey, yeah. You know, it's always a winner when you can save yourself some time, but it also looks good too. You know, this is like, wow, it's a win-win. So there you go. So again, Wyatt continues on with the flashback where they talk about the miners, and then there's the protest, and somebody gets shot, and then he disappears into the cave, and then they have to chase him. And again, you're right. This is a lot of flashbacks. There's an extensive. This is like
pages and pages.
Yeah, this is pages and pages of a flashback. This is like 10 pages of a flashback. Although, again, I thought it was, again, a nice touch that we go back to the present and then he continues the flashback again. And then now we're back in full color and the panel borders are just straight because we're sort of sensing that, okay, this is an ancient legend. This is more recent times. This is something that Wyatt Winfoot experienced sort of, if not firsthand, at least in his lifetime. So it's a little more current. Then we have another ad that we want to talk about, which is a full page Marvel ad for Spider-Woman. And it bears the headline, Ain't She Sweet? And it's got this pose of Spider-Woman drawn by Dennis Cowan and Al Milgram. It's signed, which is a little unusual. Generally, the ads didn't get signed. Spider-Woman pasting a goon who's carrying a chain and some sort of like a crowbar, not a crowbar, but like a pipe of some sort. And it's a very dynamic ad. I am questioning the anatomy of Spider-Woman, of how her body could possibly be twisted the way that it is, and that her head is her face is in profile, but her torso is not only directly facing, it's actually slightly away in the other direction, and then the legs are twisted. Like, that is, you know, it's comic book anatomy, but man, it's a striking ad.
I'm not going to argue with the anatomy because there's something about the way Dennis Cowan draws Jessica's hips and that one. That single buttock that just gets me a little tingly. So,
hey, I'm a successful ad, then.
I'm not complaining.
Did you buy the Spider-Woman comic or watch the cartoon?
I never watched the cartoon. I think I was a little too old for that.
Okay.
But I did buy the comic pretty regularly. When I found it, I bought it.
I was going to say the same thing. I did too, but I hardly ever found it. My area, it did not show up a lot.
Yeah, I think it was a little spotty, but actually just, I think it was last month, I finished my Spider-Woman run.
Oh, wow. How many issues did that run? Like 50, something like that?
I think it was. Yeah, I think it was 50. And whether they're, you know, as good or as bad as I remember, it's fun to go back and get the complete story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I don't have to spend too much money, but I like getting the missing issues and then piecing them together, you know.
I remember 50 had that amazing photo cover.
Yeah.
Dressed up models and not just Spider-Woman, but like Gypsy Moth.
Villains and yeah.
Villain. Yeah. I never saw that on the, maybe I did. I remember whenever I saw it for the first time, I remember just being like, wow, you can do that? You know, you can make costumes and hire models to do all that? That's like, wow. Yeah. That's pretty
and
cool.
If you dig around online, somebody posted the whole story, you know, their remembrance of the photo shoot.
Oh, really?
Candid photos. Yeah, it's really fascinating.
Oh, jeez. Oh, that sounds, oh, yeah, I definitely got to read that. That sounds really cool. Yeah. Oh, my God.
The way they set it up and all the staff members that they got to wear the costume, it's great.
No, that's so cool.
Well worth researching.
Marvel would do that occasionally. They would do those photo covers where they would get people dressed. There's a Marvel team up with Spider-Man, Captain America with guys in costumes. So they would once in a while, they got a wild hair and they would do that. I always thought Spider-Woman, we're turning this into the Spider-Woman show, but I always thought the Spider-Woman comic had particularly striking covers. Like if you go back and you look at, again, Mike's Amazing World and you look at the gallery, there's a lot of really, really sharp covers on that book.
Yeah.
I feel like they made maybe because the book was sales challenged. I mean, it says right here in the ad that it's bi-monthly, which is also always an indication that the book is not a big seller. And I know that the legend was mostly this was just to protect the copyright. They didn't want someone else making a Spider-Woman character, so Marvel did it themselves.
Yeah.
But I always thought there's a Frank Miller cover where there's like some Universal Monsters on it and stuff. So like Spider-Woman just had this, I think, pretty distinctive covers generally.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. That's probably a big reason why I was snagging it off the rack when I could.
So, okay, now we're back to the story. So the flashback goes even further. And then we talk about the spirit, tribal leader becomes a spirit and then disappears. We even see kind of like a little dove of peace kind of thing flying in the background. So now we're back to the present and Wyatt Windfoot tells, I need a lift to the Savage Land. And the Thing is like, okay, we can take our rocket and bang, out they go.
And can I just say that the conceit that one of the FF was, you know, banging around the Baxter Building and the other three were off doing something never got old for me. I thought that was great. And it was kind of the basis for the whole 2-in-1 series, you know.
Right, right.
Like, I love it. I mean, as much as I loved the Fantastic Four comic, I thought it was great. Like, oh, well, you know, they're off doing this and Johnny's doing that. But what can I help you? I just thought it was great.
What can I help you with?
Yeah.
The thing. Yeah.
I need your pogo plane.
Yeah. It was interesting that, you know, of the two, of all the Marvel characters, the two characters that were deemed the perfect setups for team ups were Spider-Man and the Thing. Now, Spider-Man, that's a no brainer. He's their most iconic character. But and obviously the Thing is the marquee character of the Fantastic Four, but it's interesting that like they were able somehow, I guess, you know, with mail that they got, they knew the Thing was the star, and they realized, oh, okay, he can be a team up star. Now, obviously, like I said, you could do like, you really couldn't do like a Hulk team up book because, you know, the story limitations of trying to team up with the Hulk every month. Hey, you know, Hulk's like, ah, leave me alone. But the Thing is obviously a lot more friendly. And again, it's very instructive that when Marvel 2-in-1 got canceled, it was replaced by a Thing solo comic, you know? So they realized, oh, the Thing is still kind of, and that lasted like 3 years. So the Thing was a marquee star for FF for many, many years.
Well, Peter Parker had such a great personality when he had the costume on, with all the wisecracks. And so no matter who you brought in, you could do fun things with that, you know, the way he would talk to them. And the Thing was similar. His personality was as large as he was. He was, he's just that, he's the superhero next door, I guess. he's your buddy. He's your pal. And he doesn't, you know, he would tell it like it is, and you could always get great. Anybody that knew how to, you know, write the Thing and give him the right characterization could have, you know, incredible fun with him.
Yeah. By the way, I think I mentioned this in other, some other episode we've done on some show where the Thing appeared. Ron Wilson drew a large chunk of Marvel 2-in-1. He was their regular artist on the book. And just drawing the Thing is a pain in the ass because of all the rocks. I hope he got a little bit of an extra page rate for the show. I probably didn't, but because they were probably like, look, do you want the gig or not? You know, but man, just drawing the Thing panel after panel is just like, oh my God. Cause you got the, obviously the rock formations don't match panel to panel because you're not, nobody's looking that closely, but they have to kind of be close because we all kind of know what the Thing, you know, he kind of has rocks of a certain size or whatever. Back when the Thing was the big kind of lava version, I remember Byrne changed it. I think it was almost like just to make it easier to draw. But man, month after month, having to pencil and ink this month after month had to be tedious as all get out. So
yeah, I wonder if he used little black X's on half of the rocks just so he wouldn't have to fill them in.
Yep, man, yeah. So anyway, now we're on to Into the Savage Land, and we get the American Eagle is, and it looks like he's hunting this creature that is wandering like in a stream, and of course Kazar is there, and this is the chapter two. It's a great downshot of Kazar again looking massive, like, you know, boy. But when drawn by Ron Wilson and inked by Gene Day, every guy in the story is, they look like they're 6'8" and 350 pounds. I mean, these guys are just, you know, walls of muscle. And we see Kazar, you know, I guess mistaking them, this American Eagle guy who he does not know. Is going to shoot this animal with a crossbow, because we see American Eagle has a crossbow. And then there's this really great two-page spread featuring a profile shot of American Eagle, which I think is repurposed for the cover, as he hears some rustling in a tree above him, and of course that's Kazar. Kazar jumps down, and they immediately fight, because they're Marvel characters, because of course they do. But it's a really great sequence, and I really love American Eagle's costume. It's a little, maybe a little over designed to draw it, you know, month after month if he became like sort of a regular star, but generally I think he has a very striking appearance, and that profile shot is great. I mean, I think it looks really cool.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, there's that excessive detail on the outfit. No. Just a little bit of zigzags on the sleeves and the, you know, a few feathers here and there. Mostly that headdress is the
That's
the pain in the butt.
Yeah. I mean, again, part of it is, you know, character design. You don't want to, if you're hoping your creation to go on and have a life, you have to have a character that people want to draw a lot. Now, that I know that's sort of contrary to what I just said about the Thing, but generally, if you're hoping that the American Eagle was going to become like a big star of the Marvel Universe, you want him to be a character that people are like, oh yeah, I love that character. That's always the, like, the Jack of Hearts. That's why that Jack of Hearts was never probably like a big star, because who the hell want to do that damn uniform every month? But I know, I think he's got a really striking visual. I think it's really cool. So Kazar jumps.
They say that, you know, a good character should have a strong profile.
Yep.
Or a silhouette, you know, and from front or side, he's got that.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. The headdress especially. And so the Kazar and American Eagle fight. We see that the animal in question was a unicorn, because of course it is. It's the Savage Land, and there's just a random unicorn.
But it's a savage unicorn.
Savage unicorn frolicking in a stream. And we see that it was these miners that were looking to hunt the unicorn, and that's who American Eagle was hunting, and Kazar mistook him for that. And of course, again, they fight a little. There's this moment where the fight stops for a second, and then American Eagle gets pissed off, and he rips an entire tree out of the ground with just his muscle.
Oh, I love it.
Kazar's like, you ripped that tree right out of the ground by the roots. And they continue to fight a little bit more.
That sound effect. Shrap.
Yeah, it's great. And then Kazar knees American Eagle in the chin, which was pretty rough. I mean, I've been hit in the chin with a knee, and it's not good. Oh. But that does not stop American Eagle, though. And he ends up taking Kazar out, kind of throwing him down to the ground long enough, again, for them to stop and then talk and then realize, oh, wait, no, we're not. There's no reason for us to fight. But it's a terrific sequence. And, you know, Kazar, moderate star of the DC Universe. I keep saying DC. Marvel Universe. He had his own book at this time. We actually talked about a Gazer comic last season on Mountain Comics. But, you know, it makes American Eagle look pretty cool that he can thump Kazar in his own Savage Land.
Yeah. You know, Kazar's a big dude. And then when American Eagle stands up and you see that he's even taller and bigger, even bigger, even Kazar is like, I'm an arm and arm and arm. Like, and he flat out tells him, he's like, hey, you could probably kick my butt, but I'm not going to stop, you know, defending my land. So I love that part that he just kind of gives it up to American Eagle.
And of course, two men have that in common. You know, they want to fight for their respective lands. It's something American Eagle could completely respect. There's another little flashback panel where we see American Eagle, how he arrived in the Savage Land, and he has a parachute that he jumps down in. And it made me think that, like, in another world, American Eagle would have made a great Mego doll. Because he would come with all this equipment. He's kind of got a slight Action Jackson G.I. Joe vibe to him. Okay. And then he comes with like a crossbow and a parachute. Like, you know, if American Eagle was like a Captain America level character, you could really come up with, like, you know, his jets and his this and his that. Like, he could come with a lot of fun things.
He could have been one of the big Jim, you know, characters or something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If he had been a DC character, he would have been part of that Warlord line
did,
the Remco dolls. It comes with a knife and stuff like that. Zabu shows up, Kazar's beloved Zabu.
I love this T-Rex with the hunchback.
Yeah, that's right.
Kind of a, poor guy, his arms aren't small enough, he's got to have a hunchback. That's not very fair.
Random dinosaur.
Come on, Ron Wilson.
Wanders by. Again, the Savage Land is a crazy place. So they go off. There's this great, again, another fun scene where they take off and they both, Kazar grabs a vine doing his Tarzan bit. And American Eagle grabs, I guess he grabs a vine. No, he shoots an arrow with a rope attached to it.
Yeah.
Swings it. And it just looks, I can almost hear that Spider-Man 60s music playing when he would swing to the city. Yeah. Yeah, it's really, really cool. I love it. Again, they look, and when the headdress is flowing in the breeze, like, it looks really cool. As you say, it makes a great, if you just put him in silhouette, he would be very distinctive.
Yeah.
So then we get to chapter 3, Night Falls. Thing and Wyatt Wingfoot arrive. Thing and Kazar talk, because of course they've met each other several times. We get into another flashback involving the miners, and we learn that Claw was the head mining of the head of the mining operation. Why we would let Claw
finally enters the story.
Yeah.
And of course it's in flashback.
Yeah, right. Exactly. We see all the damage that he did. Again, it's like why you would let him be the head of anything. I don't know. So again, they spend the night kind of just sleeping out in the brush, describing what's going on. And that's sort of the setup for Chapter 4, which is...
This part is great. I mean, I love that they're just sitting around shooting the breeze by the
campfire. Shooting the breeze, yeah.
And a little bit of arm wrestling. And there's... You could almost argue that there's, you know, this foreshadowing is a little heavy-handed. But at the same time, it's perfect because the Thing has never met this guy. And they're sitting around the campfire. They're talking. They're telling stories. And then the Thing just starts, he just up and asks him, you know, how strong are you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think you could take a bullet, you know? And, you know, we find out later that this is very significant. But I just think it's great the way they brought them all together around the campfire. And then more flashbacks, more story that comes out. And then we're off to the races.
I love, again, the Thing refers to, he says, why don't you tell us how you really got your powers instead of without the legend malarkey this time. What about any of this is that hard to believe, Ben? Come on.
He's such a lovable character, but almost every other thing out of his mouth is followed by no offense, you know? He's just a straight talker, but you just love him.
No offense. So we get to, again, we have the flashback where we learn American Eagle got his powers thanks to the radiation that he took in from Claw. And again, they basically decide, okay, we're gonna head out and find Claw in the morning. And again, that leads to chapter 4, which is the dinosaur graveyard. And we see all the bones of the dinosaurs and the rest of them are trussed up, which again is kind of, you know, a bit of a grim image. These poor poor creatures. I love that the claw is like, I'll keep watch. The lousy mist over his place make it so gloomy all the time. Like, I like the claw is kind of like more not like a Dr. Doom. Like, he's not erudite the way so many Marvel villains are. He's kind of more like, yeah, just kind of like a regular schmo, even though he's got gifted with all these amazing powers.
Well, like, and his dad was a Nazi.
Well, and,
you know, so maybe that explains his, you know, obsession with, you know, something that's not very rational. But anyway, I don't have much complaint about the art in this book, because it's, you know, even when things are a little stiff, I love the way, you know, Wilson carries us through it. But this opening to chapter 4 is one of the funniest parts of the whole book to me. When you're staring down into the dinosaur graveyard, and obviously he's trying to get, you know, everything crammed in there, but the scope of it is just so off. There's no way you could land a plane in there.
Yeah.
There's, you know,
it's like a football field at most.
You know? How did they build this giant cage inside this little crater? I mean, it's hard to even imagine how a dinosaur would get in there to die.
It's right. Yeah.
It's a strange setup, but I don't care. I'm buying into it.
Yeah. I mean, come on. You're along for the ride at this point. Yeah. You've paid your 75 cents. What are you doing?
And then in the bottom panel of that first page of chapter 4, where all of a sudden the claw activates, he activates his claw almost like a flashlight. Like, what's he doing down there? Just shooting it at the ground. Like he's just, I don't know. It looks like he's using it as a flashlight to me.
I knew they weren't going to do this because they were trying to maintain some level of reality, but I really was hoping that Andy Serkis would end up looking like this in the movie, because, you know, he ends up becoming Claw. No, agree. They didn't do that, but, you know,
fully agree.
He has such a great visual with this red pink face and the red unitard and the kind of the purple underpants and the very distinctive head design. I would have killed to see Andy Serkis look like this, but, you know, it's okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So then and it's funny that the wall of the dinosaur burial ground is like four stories. I mean, there's a shot where our heroes approach it and we can see him in perspective. The thing is this tiny little figure, and they have to scale it. Kazar and Zabu use their sort of hunting ability, or their climbing ability. An American Eagle shoots another arrow and climbs up with a rope, and Thing just crunches his way up. But it's like, this thing is like a building height. So you're like, yeah, how does anybody get into this thing?
And the moon is always conveniently placed, mm-hmm, right behind the characters.
Wherever they are. I love it.
Yeah, wherever that moon needs to be, that it shows up and gives a little accent. It's fantastic.
So the Thing gets to the top. He runs into Claw. And I love, again, this is such a Marvel Universe thing. The first thing that Thing thinks, that instead of punching Claw, his first instinct is like, how'd you get free? Like, they, you know, tell me a story. You know, like, it's like, what does it matter?
You're not supposed to be alive.
Yeah.
When has that ever stopped anyone?
Just punch him, Thing. What are you doing? And then we get this absolutely just such Marvel style. This is Bronze Age Marvel to a T, where we see the Thing. He was in Project Pegasus back in Marvel 2-in-1, number 58, and he got trapped inside of his own claw, and the Thing was just lying around. The blaster was just laying on the ground, and the Project Pegasus cleaning lady, who looks like, you know, Mabel or something, like a very sort of 1950s kind, just picked it up and accidentally turned it on, and that released Claw. And I mean, I got to say, things are pretty loose over at Project Pegasus.
At this point in my comic book reading career, if you want to call it that, Project Pegasus was my be-all, end-all. And it practically still is to this day. That six-parter was just the pinnacle to me of what made Marvel fantastic. And just the fact that they mentioned it, that, you know, that they just referred back to it at all, you know, made me giddy this time, and I'm sure the very first time I read this book. But I went back and looked at issue 58, and Wondar had made a had a metamorphosis. He had transformed into a character called Aquarian. He suddenly found himself. Aquarian. And the last time we see the claw, we thought that the thing was done for and that the claw was gonna just blast his head at close range. But Wundar inadvertently disrupts the claw's device and the claw gets sucked in. And you see the Aquarian holding the device in this one panel. But by the next panel, they're walking away and you don't see it at all. And I just thought that was perfect. Just so perfect that they, you know, just between the lines there, you know, between the panels, just pulling that out of there.
You just dropped it. Forget it. Who cares?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know you were in trouble. I just was wandering by and disrupted the energy. And now I'm holding this thing. Let's go.
Aquarian's got stuff to do. I don't have time to waste. So,
and okay. The fact that, oh my God, that Munch, I took her out gently before she even knew what was happening. After all, I ain't a total ingrate.
he blasts her.
He blasts her. Did he kill her? Or did he just knock her out? Either way, like, come on, man. She just brought you back from the brink, and then the first thing he does is blast this poor cleaning lady.
I took that as that he killed her. When he says, I took her out gently, I just feels like that he killed her for her troubles. So,
but this whole page, to quote Rob Kelly, chef's kiss.
It's so Marvel Comics of a certain age. It just is, you know. I love it. Thanks, lady. It was kind of cramped in there.
I mean, I still get giddy for editor's notes. I just love it.
Yeah. Oh, see, Marvel 2-in-1, number 58, D.A.K., which is David Anthony Kraft, who was the editor. So, yeah. And then Claude tells him the story, and then they fight. So
it's another
flashback. Yep. I mean, I love, again, it's like, okay, you've now heard my new origin story. Now let's fight. Okay. and then they, you know, then the fight starts to break out where American Eagle is fighting his brother and the Claw is blasting the thing, and we get, as you mentioned, Wyatt Wingfoot gets his kind of one moment of action where he picks up a rock. And again, you know, like the rock that Wyatt Wingfoot throws is the size of the Hulk's head. I mean, it's not a pebble, it's a boulder.
I don't know. Maybe there's a little force perspective going on there, because when it bounces off the Claw's device,
it's smaller. Yeah.
You could maybe think, okay, it's like a big enough to fit in the hand, but he threw it pretty far.
Yeah, he's on the ground outside the dinosaur graveyard, and he throws it 40 feet in the air, as we've seen. So, yeah, I mean, again, if I tried to throw a rock that size, it would go about a foot and a half, and then just that would be the end of that.
My dislocated arm would fly farther than the rock.
Exactly. And then so he manages to hit Claw's blaster, which gives the thing long enough time to tackle him. And again, as far as I know about the Claw, like, Claw is not like super, I didn't look up his listing in the, you know, Hotmu, but I don't think Claw is particularly like super strong. He just has that, he's made of energy and he has that blaster, but like the thing tackles him. I think if the thing tackles you and you land on the ground, you're probably going to get crushed, because the thing weighs probably what, two tons?
Yeah, but the physics with Claw's body, who knows what's going on there?
He's made of energy, so
yeah, like sound solidified. So it's not going to not going to hold up under scrutiny. But the fact that you know, he can get sucked into his own device, and sometimes he's solid, sometimes he's not. I guess he can take it.
Right. Claw blasts the dinosaur cage, which allows the dinosaurs to go berserk. Zabu attacks one of the dinosaurs and stops him from attacking the thing. Kazar stops him. He looks like Kazar stabs one of the dinosaurs in the neck with his knife.
Doesn't just look like it.
He does. Actually, he says he does it right there. Definitely. Kazar's knife, itself a silver fang, plunges again and again until the horde of savage beasts breaks and scatters it. I wouldn't think this said Kazar would be doing that he would be killing dinosaurs of the Savage Land. I mean,
I like to think that he knows that it won't kill him. He's just trying to hold him at bay.
I guess so, yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't stack up with, you know, I wouldn't see him plunging that into the unicorn's neck if it was charging. But yeah. And then Zabu's sinking his teeth into another one, and
yep.
Yeah, I started to get a little misty for the dinosaurs.
Here. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, they're all kind of rare. I know the Savage Land is a crazy world, you know, separate from the regular Marvel universe. But okay, so then American Eagle and his brother continue the fight. We see American Eagle picks up a boulder, a massive boulder. His brother manages to Ward manages to smack it out of the way. They continue on with this fight again. This is
and his brother picked up a giant dinosaur tooth, which was pretty
that's
cool.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, actually, I don't think it was a tooth. It was like a rib
or something. Yeah, exactly. Cool. But again, the thing fight is kind of off to the side while the major battle is this end piece, while the American Eagle and his brother are fighting. So then we stop a moment, for the fight to get an ad, a Hostess fruit pie ad featuring the Hulk versus the Fumi Goonies. Which are, you know, maybe not one of the more intimidating sets of villains to even appear in even a Hostess ad. I mean, they're probably above the Dingaling family, but maybe...
Well, they are terrorists.
They are terrorists. They even mentioned you're all hostages now with a revolutionary government. I feel like this was probably written by Doug Minch as well or something, that there's like a political aspect to even a Hostess ad. And they're in a post office, and they break in, and the Bruce Banner, of course, turns into the Hulk, picks up all three of the Fumi Goonies, and they're thrown in jail, and they don't mind because they are busy eating the Hostess fruit pies. I love the touch in the final panel of Bruce Banner doing the pitch for the fruit pies, and his clothes are ripped up because he's back to his post-Hulk transformation. I just think that's such a great detail.
And he says, I'll send the Fumi Goonies a bill for the kids' Hostess fruit pies and for my new clothes, which he hasn't purchased yet.
I love it. That's great. Oh, my God. It's just so fun. I know that copyright-wise you can't do it because of the characters, but, man, this really needs to be a book of all the Hostess ads. Someone, you know, you can do it online, and there are sites online where you can see them all. And the problem is that these were done across DC and Marvel and Archie and Harvey, and just you couldn't get the licensing to do it. But boy, it would be fun to get a nice, you know, collection and a full listing of who wrote them, who drew them. Frank Miller did one of them, for Pete's sakes. I would have. Captain Marvel got his own Red Tornado. I mean, Richie Rich had them.
I was delighted to find out that, and I don't know who did it, who designates these things. But there's a designated Marvel universe for the Hostess ads. Just like the regular Marvel universe is Marvel, you know, 616.
Yeah.
There is a dedicated, I don't remember what it is. It's like a five number, you know, five digit number. It's like 91342. But I just thought that was hilarious.
I love that.
That made me think that as much as there should be a book documenting these ads, how great would it be to get like a Spidey Super Stories style book where it's just in that universe where you've got the Marvel heroes and all those villains? I mean, that would be a treat too if it was done.
That really would be. I wish that Disney would maybe be a little more adventurous. I'm just making up words with their Disney Plus. I mean, you could shoot like a little 2-minute interstitial and just put it up on Disney Plus of have them like pitching a Disney product or something and just make it like a Hostess ad, you know, just get the character, get Hawkeye pitching something or Miss Marvel or She-Hulk or whatever. Just, you know, there's the room. Now they've got a whole channel to themselves. You could,
I guess they kind of did that with, Steve Rogers and one of the movies where he wasn't he on screen doing, public service announcements.
Yes,
and things,
he's in one of the Spider-Man movies. Yeah, where he does like a little PSA, and I know they even did the shorts and stuff like that. But just I don't know. The Hostess ads are just such a beloved part of my childhood, and they ran so briefly. You know, they were around for about 5 years, and then never again. And I think to comic audiences of a certain age, it's like, what the hell is that? You know, what are these things? But to people who grew up on them, they're just utterly charming. Again, I love Bruce Banner's clothes being torn up. just such a great and verisimilitude little touch there.
And so, when I looked up, when I was looking into this ad as well, I seem to remember on the Marvel website, they they said that the Fumi Goonies first appeared in like 1981. So I think this ad, you know, this ad had been around for a few years. It first appeared like in an Avengers comic. So, you know, they would recycle them, you know, along the way, and they'd show up in different titles. But I think the Fumi Goonies were already, you know, this had already been published for a few years by the time this came out.
So wait, the Fumi Goonies are real Marvel Universe characters?
No, just this ad.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, okay. I was like, whoa, wait a minute. when did they show up?
But it said like first appearance, you know, wow. It was in an Avengers comic from 1981. So this ad had been, you know, they were still using it. They were still floating around. And
that's funny. Oh, geez.
The same ads popping up here and there.
I really hope some of these characters eventually show up in a movie just as a nod. Like, I could see the Dingaling family showing up in the Thor Love and Thunder if they have the time to do it. That seems like something that Taika Waititi would do if he knew about it. So anyway, back to the fight. American Eagle and his brother are kicking the living crap out of each other. Thing and Claw finally end their fight, where Thing finally clocks Claw. And then one of the miners takes a shot at American Eagle, but of course misses and ends up killing Ward, ends up shooting him. And American Eagle is naturally, of course, pretty pissed about that. Although he doesn't actually fight the miners. He threatens them and then they just run away. The dinosaurs eventually kind of take off. I don't exactly understand the physics of this. Like, where are they going? Like, did they climbing the wall? Like, is there an exit? We don't see one.
No, the dinosaurs are still in there.
I guess so.
They can't escape. They're just running in circles.
I guess so. Yeah, I guess that's what it is. So, and then the miners get killed by the dinosaurs. They get trampled in their path. And the thing says, gulp, what a way to go. And Kiz is like, amen, Grim, and yet they only brought it on themselves.
I'm kind of a sucker for the endings where the villain, you know, they get killed and the heroes are not responsible for the death. I'm a sucker for that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they maintain their, you know, their heroic credibility and the reader gets a satisfying death.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the miners are terrible and you want to see them, you know, they're murderers and whatever. And so, yeah, it's like trampled to death by dinosaurs is pretty grim. And then you get American Eagles going, then it is done. My mission here is finished. And we get Kazar talking to Thing, and Thing is carrying carrying Claw by the shoulder in a kind of ignominious style. We see the Claw, yeah. I think presumably is still unconscious because he looks kind of supine there. And then we get this final panel, which I would argue a little too small for the end. I wish American Eagle had just a little more space there, but I guess they, you know, we have so many pages and they gotta fit it in. But the final shot in the book is American Eagle again, which to me underscores this is really his story.
Yeah. In just the last few panels, it feels like it wraps up just a little too fast.
Yep.
Even though, you know, it's already been I think it's how many,
38 page story. Yeah.
But there's something also about that final panel being small that kind of makes you feel small, like he feels now, you know, that his brother is gone. But I agree that they kind of painted themselves into a little corner. It kind of works, but
yeah, it's maybe just paced a little, you know, maybe a couple less panels of dinosaurs rampaging or Hulk and Claw maybe getting, you know, just this final page probably could have used a little more space. But otherwise, it's a very attractive comic. I think Gene Day makes a fine inker for Ron Wilson. I like Ron Wilson's a very solid superhero artist. And I said I like the American Eagle design. Now, I had never seen the character again. I'd never ran across a comic that he was in. So I looked him up, and he actually continued to make some appearances, not a lot, but he went right after this. He appeared in the Contest of Champions miniseries. Now, I bought that series. I don't remember him in it, so I don't think he had a huge role. And he had he had guest appearances in The Hulk and Rom the Space Knight. And then after that, he kind of disappeared for a long time, and then he eventually came back in the 90s, and he was given his own his own feature. He headlined his own story in a Marvel Comics Presents issue, and he's been kind of rejiggered and given like a new costume and a little less.
I think they used him in the Thunderbolts.
I think he's in Thunderbolts.
Maybe about 10 years ago or something.
Yep.
He stuck around a little bit.
Yeah, he stuck around. And he did get a listing in Ohotmu. And I was curious because I went back and listened to Ohotmu episode 2, of course, a show on our very network, because I wanted to see what the girls thought of American Eagle. And he was rated hot. The girls, the consensus was that he, in fact, was hot. So there you go. Because they said they, nice. You know, Siskoid pointed out in his listing that he's kind and he's thoughtful. So the girls, of course, like that. So yeah, thumbs up across the board on Ohotmu for American Eagle. So like I said, I didn't really see the character. This is really my only experience with him. But rereading this comic, I liked him a lot, and I wish maybe they had done more with him. There's lots of Marvel characters, and you can only do so much with all the various properties that are out there. But I feel like there could have been more. I think he had a lot going for him, and considering what a really wonderful platform this is, I mean, he gets an annual, and he's the cover marquee co-star. I mean, and you could see in other comics where this would be the thing in Kazar, featuring the debut of American Eagle. Mm-hmm. But American Eagle gets his own logo. Oh. I mean, they really did.
Yeah.
So overall, this is a really fun comic. It was fun when I read it in 1981, and it was fun again reading it for this show.
Wait a minute. Is this from 19? I was thinking this was a few years later than 1981.
No, this is 81, yeah.
I was getting my dates mixed up. But okay, so yeah, in regards to that Hostess ad, I was mistaken. So it did debut this year.
They ran them probably across the year or something. Yeah, like that. But I never know how they chose to run those things. You know, like how long did they run them? Did like one ad get 2 months, 3 months? You know what I mean? Like some ads you seem to see more than others, especially in like the DC books. I saw like the same Batman ones over and over again. And Red Tornado, I think I saw like once or twice.
I went down a little bit of a Mike's Amazing World rabbit hole.
Oh, it's so easy to do.
And if you'll indulge me for just 1 second.
Of course.
So this came out July 14, 1981.
Yep.
I had just turned 13 the day before it came out.
Wow.
And this was, you know, 13. Like, that's, don't you feel like that was maybe like your peak comic book consuming?
Oh, totally.
Yeah, right?
Totally.
So Frank Miller had just introduced Elektra a few months before this.
Big,
so
that big title, doings.
That title was on fire. Uncanny X-Men 150 came out the same day as this book. The Defenders were just about to reach issue 100 in another week.
Another great comic, yeah.
As you mentioned earlier, Sienkiewicz's Moon Knight was going on. Micronauts, Master Kung Fu had just gone over issue 100. Power Man and Iron Fist, ROM, those were big for me. But so in this month of July 1981, if you had to guess, who do you think put out more comics that month, Archie or Harvey?
Oh, it had to be Harvey.
Archie put out 16 titles that month.
Yeah.
Harvey released 18 that were just Richie Rich.
Yeah. It boggles the mind how many titles that little run had. Yeah.
18 Richie Rich comics came out in July of 81. Gold Key put out 19 books. Charlton, 10.
Gold Key put out 19 books?
19 books.
They were, I didn't know they
DC
were going that strong then.
32, and Marvel, of course, 41.
Wow.
41 books. So this was, I mean, comics were, you know, comics were big and
they were humming.
They were popular at that time. They were, yeah. It was a good time to be a comic reader.
Jeez. I've seen some interviews in like Comic Book Buyer's Guide, not Comic Buyer's Guide, excuse me, Comic Book Artist, that great magazine that doesn't exist anymore. But
that was a good magazine.
Yeah, I love that magazine. And they interviewed like Ernie Colon, who worked on Richie Rich, and they asked him about, like, you know, God, at one point you guys were like, you know, 15 Richie Rich titles. And you know, he was like, yeah, we sold a lot. I would, you know, there are books on Harvey. I've read one of them. But there is, as far as I know, no big in-depth examination of that company. And I just want, like, how are they possibly selling that many Richie Rich titles? If Batman only got five titles in a month, how is Richie Rich selling that many? But I mean, they wouldn't be publishing them.
Issues in 1 month. I mean, there was Richie Rich's Gems, Richie Rich's Riches, Richie Rich's Money, Richie Rich's Moolah. There were a lot of titles. And you think compared to Archie, you know, Archie had Archie's Pals and Gals, Archie's Friends, Archie's Little Archie, the, you know, but somehow they managed to outdo Archie. Can't believe it.
It's just amazing. I you know, again, contra my image of being a little rich boy, and I know my pal David Iscutieres loves to refer to me as Richie Rich. I never bought Richie Rich comics. I was not interested. Once in a while, I would buy an Archie if I was really kind of desperate, but I considered that stuff, you know, I'm like, oh, that's kid stuff. I don't want to read that.
Oh, I didn't. I did love the Archie.
Oh, did you?
Okay. Yeah, that carried through to this day. I still enjoy the, I don't know, there's just such a fun feeling, just a fun vibe. You know, I didn't grow up in the 50s, you know, right. but there's something about that, just that, I don't know, there's just a feeling about it when everybody's just a little more carefree in that book.
But yeah, no, I never bought Richie Rich. I just was like, no, I'm not interested in that. So, but yeah, 18 titles, somebody was buying them. Somebody, and again, when I think about it, I hardly ever even saw them on newsstands. So where were they being sold? I mean, if he was selling 18 titles a month, how is he not showing up in my area?
I think that it was 90% the barbershop and doctor's office subscriptions.
You know, I would love to read that. I would love to know.
That would be fascinating.
Hey, if you're listening out there, if you know anything about the Richie Rich and history of Harvey, let us know in the comments, because I would find that stuff really fascinating. So, this is a great comic. It's one of my favorite Mountain Comics, and I am so glad that we finally got a chance to talk about it. So, Dallin, thank you so much for doing this, man. It's always a blast to talk to you, and I really appreciate you taking this trip with me to the Poconos cabin.
Well, it's been a pleasure. The sun is just starting to go down, and you can see it, you know, the reflection on the lake. I've got a whole case of yoo-hoos here, Rob. The night doesn't have to end right now.
That's right. We're going to be like the Thing in Kazar. We're going to be talking all night, just doing arm wrestling and other stuff like that. Get a campfire going. It's going to be great. I can take a bullet. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
I am Dallin B, DallanB on Twitter. And that's the only real place to talk comics with me.
Okay. Do that, everybody. Down's a lot of fun. So, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. We're always talking these particular comics over on Twitter at FWP Mountain Com. You can subscribe to Mountain Comics now. As I mentioned last episode, the show now has its own feed on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, and you can subscribe to it on any podcatcher of your choice. And then finally, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. We would very much appreciate it. So that is going to do it. As Dallin said, he's got a case full of yoo-hoo, so we're going to crack a few more open.
Well, this is where I tell you that you're doing God's work. Thank you, Rob. Wow, keep it up. Right. Keep up the great podcast, the great network. You're making a lot of people very happy, so thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. That's very nice of you to say. I appreciate it. Yeah, I love doing this show, and you know, I do it just in the summer because it's such a summer thing, but I miss it when I don't do it. And I missed it last year because I was busy doing other things, but now I'm very happy that it's back. And there's just so many more fun comics to talk about. So again,
thanks for inviting me on.
Oh, of course, very much. So again, thanks everybody for listening, and we will see you next month. Until then, like I said, Down and I are going to knock back a few more yoo-hoos at the cabin. And again, we'll see you next month.
Oh, this one's missing the straw. Oh man, that's a bummer. We got more. That's okay. We have more.
We got more. We're fine. So, all right, everybody, we'll see you next month. Bye.
Have a summer of fun in the Poconos. At your host with the most in the Poconos. Beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Have every kind of summer fun at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Beautiful rooms, fabulous food, headline entertainment. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and...
Beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.